Oh, the shape up or get. If you've let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I'm Raf Giallo. As always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter. That's at Team 33. We're also on Facebook and also on iTunes. And you can get some of the interviews that we do on the Off The Ball YouTube channel, including Stephanie Roach this week. She is an ambassador for Londis Ireland, and they are sponsoring Helen Back, which I once did before, which happens
in
Bray.
Oh, I remember you doing that, Raf.
Kilrodery House.
I didn't do it. Yeah, I remember you doing it, though.
Yeah, Helen Back?
Yeah, he did.
I don't know this about you.
There was
a News Talk cohort who did it at the time. I opted out. Oh.
very surprise.
Very smart decision. Yeah, there's myself, Jess Kelly. There were a couple of other people as well that were involved.
Richard Chambers did it.
No, I think he had to pull out as
well.
There's the lads opted out on the day,
yeah,
I believe.
That old dodgy hamstring.
Yeah, no.
And you finished it?
Yeah.
Fair play to you.
Yeah, 10 kilometres.
I wouldn't even go and look at it.
It was a tough, warm day as well.
I'm very lazy.
As well, which made it all the more difficult.
Well done,
so just wading through mud, water.
They do call it Hell and Back, Raf.
They do, yeah.
The clue's in the name, really.
Yeah. I was flying the first kind of kilometre and then I got hit hard.
How long is it?
It's 10.
Oh, it's 10.
Yeah. It took a while. And like the last half of it, I was just kind of praying for a carvery dinner in the pub, which I did eventually have as well. So it is an aid also of Pieta House. We'll play that interview out a little bit later on, but if you're looking for it, it is podcasted anyway, Off The Wall website and iTunes. But Joe Coffey is here.
Raf, great
Derek
to be
Ryan.
Here.
Hello.
And Andy Call.
Hi, Raf.
Right, so a interesting weekend in terms of bank holidays and that, and ended with Vincent Kompany's blockbuster finish against Leicester City. Were you one of the ones kind of shouting, don't shoot, or were you watching it?
I actually missed it, I didn't get to see it.
Absolutely shouting, do not shoot, Vincent Kompany, what are you doing? I mean, there's absolutely no chance of him scoring from there. Like, he's the one player, as one of the lads said last night on Sky, he's the one player on the City team who you'd be like, of all players, do not shoot. You're the one who's going to miss. Now, at the same time, Vincent Kompany is a decent footballer. Like, he's not a big block of a centre half. Like, he actually is a decent footballer, but still, of all players in the City team, he's the one who you'd expect to blaze that right over the bar, a la Kyle Walker did in the first 5 minutes of the game as well. So, fair play to him.
Yeah, well, look, I know he was kind of going on about like post match where some of the younger players, I think he was implying, are kind of telling them, please don't shoot. And well, he is the captain, so it's really
that was the point, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a bit like he was like, I've come so far in my career, I could shoot whenever I want.
Well, yeah, and fairness to him, he's dead right. Like, younger fellas, to you know, like he's
but like,
Kompany's done it all.
At the same time, did you see there's a shot from behind Kompany when he scored?
Yeah,
and there's a couple of lads going out to the toilet.
Oh, for God's
sake. So you can see a guy going out to the toilet just as Kompany shooting. So he missed the goal. He was about 3 seconds away from, well, a second away from the goal.
A couple of minutes before that, I was chatting to my mates about it and how well Kompany was playing, considering the pre-match talk about him being done for pace. And
by Jamie Vardy.
Yeah, and he was basically the man of the match up until that. And it reminded me of his performance against United a few years ago when he scored that header, which basically sealed the title. And it was about 2 minutes before that, Liverpool had Man City had a corner, and we were saying, you know what, it wouldn't surprise me if Vincent Kompany had a big role to play in this game. And then 2 minutes later, he does that. So
yeah, and the fact is, he only arrived for what, 6 million at the time, something paltry enough from, I believe it was at Hamburg at the and it was even properly before the massive takeover.
I think it was during the Thai takeover, wasn't it?
Yes.
So when Mark Hughes was there. So when they signed Zabaleta then as well.
Oh, yeah.
Who ended up obviously also being, like, they signed a couple of decent players.
Yeah, money well spent. Well, actually,
money well spent.
Some of their best spending was in that period.
Well, even Aguero came after that, but very early on. Some of their best signings have come in that first few years.
David Silva was in that period as well.
Like, if you look at the the travails of Arsenal and United of recent years,
which we will talk about.
It all stems from bad buy after bad buy for both clubs. I mean, United have spent more than Arsenal, but if you look at all the Arsenal players now and all the really bad players of the team, of which there are many, most of them are just disastrous signings that have been made in a panic near the end of the season, not really well thought out. Were kind of made because they went around saying, oh yeah, we're interested in about six world-class players before a season ticket renewals come up. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, Jesus, we weren't able to get any of those players, but look, here's this average player for everyone to get excited about.
I think Arsenal have actually bought really well this year, though. I know it didn't really translate onto the pitch this year.
Yeah, this season.
But when you look forward, it could be like a City situation where Torreira is pretty young yet.
Exactly.
Guendouzi is really young. I know Lichtsteiner and the Greek lad, what do you call him?
Socrates.
Yeah, they're getting on.
Yeah, but he's actually Socrates has been okay. Yeah,
they've been adding
surname, are you?
Socrates.
They added a bit of like maturity to the side as well as bringing in the youngsters. So I to be honest, it didn't translate this year at all, but it will translate. Aubameyang has been a good signing. Lacazette's been a good signing.
The issue for Arsenal is that while they are definitely the silver lining, there is a massive cloud hanging over the team. And even, I mean, we'll go into it later on, but I'll just start.
Let's go into it now.
Do you want to go into it now?
Yeah, why not?
I mean,
I've had enough of City.
Okay,
so
let's go
Arsenal and United.
You look at where Arsenal are now. So they're 4 points better off than they were this time last season. They've by and large scored the same amount of goals and by and large conceded the same amount of goals. Their collapse has been astounding.
even for them,
the collapse has been nothing short of astounding, considering they'll never be given an easier opportunity to get into the Champions League with every team around them losing. I mean, when I was looking at their fixtures, I was going, if they get 10 points now, I'd say they'll be in with a good shout. No, they actually got one. 1 point
from four games.
They lost three in a row and then they got a point against Brighton. And they somehow beat Watford through a fluke. But I think that what Enza said is true, that the players that they signed last summer, by and large, other than Lichtensteiner, would look like decent buys. The Denis Suarez thing didn't work out, and Emery said in January they had no money to buy anyone on a permanent basis anyway. I think the club were sold this dream back in 2006 about moving to a new stadium to compete with the elite. Now they're at a situation where they're not even competing with Everton and Wolves in the transfer market.
But to be fair to Unai Emery, and I'm sure you're not calling for him.
No, not at all.
Rome wasn't built in a day, and I'm a bit, you know.
It's not him. He's not the issue. The issue I have with it is that we're been told, if reports are to be believed, Arsenal will have about £40 million to spend in the summer. This is for supposedly a big English super club that's valued at £2.2 billion.
£40 million won't get you an average midfielder.
Exactly.
Ramsey's replacement.
Like, if you're looking at the transfer market now, the likes of a 50 million player now is what a 15 million player would have been.
Yeah, exactly. Get your Neymar's left toe.
Yeah,
maybe.
Exactly. If you're
big toe.
Say for example,
not the little ones.
Jordan Henderson. I remember Liverpool signed him for 18 million at the time. That's what you're getting for 50 million now.
Exactly.
You're getting one
exactly.
of those players.
Yeah. Fred
will
was
do
50
the
mil.
Job. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, he's
and he's not even playing.
He's not even Jordan Henderson standard. So I'll tell you where he's at the minute.
But
and Riyad Mahrez, by the way, I realised he was 60 mil for City, and he hasn't been playing
very often.
Like he's very much a squad player for City, and that's all he is.
That's the thing that City have been doing in the last transfer windows is they haven't been seeking out players and identifying weak spots. They've been kind of just, oh God, no, Aguero's out for two months. Let's go back, spend 80 million on a striker and replace him. That's what they've been doing. They've been just, anytime a player gets injured, they just go out and buy another player instead of.
Fair enough. Most clubs can't compete with to the way they can compete, but like Liverpool have spent big.
What about the net spend, Joe? Though, what about the net? It's all about that net spend. It didn't exist until Liverpool started spending money.
I suppose they did. They have sold some big players. They have done well out of some of their signings, but I mean, like you look at say even like Arsenal have been so so tight in the transfer market over the years, like the famous Suarez incident, and like you know you look at it and you go, you know, you look at that and you go, to how has it benefited the club? They've continued to do this summer after summer to try and be cheap in the transfer market. And in the end, all you're seeing is the club gradually being eroded into a mid-table team who's good in the cups, hopefully.
And you look at Liverpool as well, and they've spent well. I mean, I know they've spent big, but they spent well. I mean, Virgil van Dijk is probably worth twice as much as he was signed for.
And like, should they, like, they
and Salah the same. Like, I don't know how much Salah was signed for. 30 odd mil, was he, Salah?
Well, the thing
yeah,
that's
something along those lines,
and like he'd be worth 100. You know what I mean? So they've spent big. I mean, that's one thing. A lot of Liverpool fans kind of go on now, kind of slagging off City as if City have spent a lot of money, but Liverpool haven't exactly been going to League One for their signings.
No, they have spent big, of course, that's
but they spend very, very well.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're spending well, and like, I don't see how Arsenal could not compete with Liverpool in the transfer market. I mean, they're both very well supported clubs, who both have decent sized stadiums. Arsenal have the luxury of being a London club, which should help in attracting players. But the problem I see with Arsenal is the fact that their owner doesn't seem to be willing to invest in the actual team. He sees the team as an asset and something to pull money out of, but doesn't seem to realise that, like, eventually if you keep stripping an asset, you're not really going to have an asset anymore.
It's sort of bad business in a way. They have no direction and no...
They're a shambles.
Yeah, they have no real... I don't know, what would you call it, game plan when it comes to the
market.
When you look at the likes of Liverpool and City are similar in a way, the way they spend. Liverpool buy players in the hope that they can develop them into the likes of Van Dijk, who they bought for 75 million, but they'll sell for 180 million. Yeah. The likes of Coutinho, Suarez, they're all similar players, whereas Man City, they'll buy a player who's going to have longevity for the likes of David Silva was bought for big money, Aguero was bought for big money, but those players are lasting 8 or 9 years at the club, so they're getting value for money out of it. And Alexa United and Arsenal, there's no game plan like that. There's no thought process. It's just, let's get these players in to fill holes as long as we can, and we might be able to offload them, but we might not at the same time. It's like, United need to do a clear out. But who's going to take those players?
Well, the Arsenal have the same problem in that. So this summer, they would really need to be getting, if you could go through the team, if you look at defence, they really need to be getting rid of Mustafi. Lichtensteiner is obviously leaving. And Jenkinson is leaving as well. And Jenkinson never really got to play, but he is on a big contract if rumours are to be believed. If you go into midfield, they need to get rid of Xhaka, they need to get rid of Ozil. Ramsey's going anyway. That's three players. They need to get rid of Elneny as well. You know, that's four players. Danny Welbeck is leaving. I'm definitely leaving out somebody. I know Lacazette, Barcelona is rumoured to be interested in Lacazette. He's one of the few players whose value's actually gone up since he signed for the club.
See, that's where the bad business comes in as well.
Awobi, they need to get rid of Awobi as well.
Arsenal are going to now make a loss on those players.
Yeah.
They're going to take a hit financially on those players, and the likes of Ramsey, they had to let go for free because they weren't ready to fulfill his contract.
Exactly.
And it's the same situation over at Manchester United as well, because the likes of David De Gea, like, he's only at the club because they extended his contract on 1 year. And the same is happening now with a couple of players where they just have this clause in the contract whereby they've got it. If they get to the final year, they can add on the contract for another year, instead of signing a 4 or 5 year deal. And that's what's happening at Arsenal as well.
Yeah.
That's why Ramsey left, because his contract go down so low.
And the reality, the reality is, to sign a player of the equivalent ability of Aaron Ramsey, and Ramsey's not even a top level midfielder. He's a very good midfielder.
But there's your 40 mil.
Oh yeah, 100%. At least 40 million. Like,
yeah, there's your 40 mil gone. If that's your transfer budget, that's pretty much gone.
And I mean, I just... There's not much to be excited about looking at Arsenal. I think people have to accept that Arsenal are just going to exist as a team for certainly while the current chairman or the current owner is in place. They're going to be a top eight team who might run in cups. Like, I mean, you're not like even under Wenger, when Arsenal signed all their great players that Wenger had, you know, did very well with, they spent a lot of money signing those players. I mean, like, Thierry Henry cost something like £13 million when he was signing. That was back in 1999. Mm. I think it was 99. It was either 1999 or 2000. he didn't sign him, but Bergkamp was a club record, 7.5 million in 95.
I mean, Sol Campbell was signed from Spurs. I can guarantee he was a massive contract when he signed. They spent
Got him on a free, but he would have been on a big contract.
If rumors are to be believed, they spent most of that what the transfer fee because they weren't paying a transfer fee, they were able to offer him the contract he was looking for. And then so like if you're looking at that, I mean, even you know even Viltor, like, you know, players like that they probably hoped they might have got more out of it, but were still decent. He cost £15 million. And like, that's, you know, you're going back 17, 18 years ago. And the reality is Arsenal are still signing players for that value. It's kind of mental, like, in that, like, they're signing players in and around at that value. And expecting to compete, it's the equivalent of if you go back in time to then, if they were signing players for 3 or 4 million expecting to compete, it just wouldn't happen. Maybe even less if you're signing players for 2 million and expecting supporters to get excited about it.
Well, I think Wenger did it well in the second team he created, so the one with Fabregas, etc. He brought a lot of them through young, like Van Persie. I think was only 2.5 million or something like that. Nothing huge, but like lots of potential, obviously.
But the thing about it was that he was able to do that at the time because Arsenal were in the top two teams in England in the Champions League every season. Wenger was regarded as a revolutionary who would improve every footballer that came to you. If you went and played football for Wenger, you were going to get better as a footballer.
Yeah, now, most clubs didn't have scouting networks across the country.
It's like United.
In that same way.
Like back in the day, United were able to take their pick of players. You know, you came to the club because you wanted to play for Manchester United. You wanted to play under Ferguson. And yeah, you got paid a lot of money, but you were probably could have got paid more money elsewhere, but you still came to United because it was United. And nowadays, you're going to United because you can earn 400K.
Yeah.
A week
and not try
and then, like, you know, your punishment is to get your contract paid off, you know what I mean? So there's no real downside.
No, like,
in terms of, you know what I mean, you can go not really try that hard and still walk away with millions in the bank.
And like, if you look at the, I know this level of the Premier League that we have this season isn't something that we're going to see every season, but like Arsenal and United, and to be honest, really being realistic, Arsenal, United, Spurs and Chelsea, to a lesser extent, are so far off the pace, it's unbelievable. I mean, Spurs have lost, is it 13 games now this season? Yeah. It's insane. 13 games and they're still finishing fourth in the league.
And they were title challengers until what, March, February probably?
February, like, I think it's kind of collapsed for them around February, yeah.
But like, they were within what, 4 or 5 points of the two top two until February, and they were like, Spurs can actually win the league here, and then they just completely fell.
And Spurs are an example of a team that they got a great bunch of players together, like obviously some of them through youth systems and everything. And but they're like Arsenal, they're not spending any money now because they have the stadium. Maybe now we'll see what happens in the summer. But all they have to do is look over to Arsenal and see what happens if you continuously refuse to spend decent money on your team.
I think around about the 2010 mark, when the Champions League money became totally ridiculous, that's when it became a thing where you have to spend now.
Yeah.
Because every club is earning the same amount of money to be there. And I think Arsenal got complacent in that sense, that Stan Kroenke was there and he was happy enough with a top four finish every year under Wenger. And I think Wenger took the blame for it a lot, which, to be fair, he does have a bit of a blame to take on his shoulders, but Kroenke, in a way, and the Arsenal board, they were more than happy getting Champions League top four and Arsene Wenger, Wenger taking them there every single year, earning the same amount of money by spending less and less and less every single year. And why wouldn't you? If you're a business head, if you're the likes of Ed Woodward and the Glazers, why would you not do the same? And it wasn't until Arsene Wenger missed out in the Champions League for that 1 year that Arsenal finally decided, you know what, we'll start pushing you out now.
Yeah.
And I would say if Arsenal hadn't missed Champions League, if Arsenal had a kept getting there under Wenger, Arsenal wouldn't have pushed them out. They would have kept
The model worked until Man City got all their money, and then Spurs actually turned out to be a team that was building towards something, and then Arsenal kind of found themselves. Because the top four used to be a cartel where it was only those four clubs, United, Chelsea, Liverpool, Arsenal, and then you didn't really have anybody else. I remember they used to be like miles ahead.
Yeah.
And then that bridge completely collapsed under Arsenal. And
it's the football
slipped,
football is secondary now to the Champions League.
Exactly.
The UEFA money is so ludicrous, and the business are thriving so well that it's the same reason why Chelsea sack their managers every 3 years, because that business model is successful. because you turn out these managers, it doesn't matter how bad it looks in a football sense or how mental it might be for players to continually have to develop a new skill or develop a new game plan under a new manager and tactics change, supporters that don't have any identity with the club. It doesn't matter because they're getting Champions League football every 3 years or winning the league every couple of 3 years. It's
that you're right. That plan has worked for Chelsea, and it's mad because obviously it's not working for United in any way, shape or form. Obviously there's a director of football at Chelsea, or there has been for the last 10 years, and there's been some sort of semblance of continuity at Chelsea, which there hasn't been at United when they've sacked their managers and brought in a different, completely different manager, and who brings in completely different players. But Chelsea have won, like, the league, 2015 they won it, 2010 they won it. They're winning leagues every few years.
Yeah, Chelsea are the most successful English club in the past 15 years.
Yeah,
if you look at it, and it's because of their model of,
which is mad.
2 years, sack the manager, bring in a new guy, completely changes it, starts again, wins the league. Bang, sack him 2 years' time.
Yeah, so they won, sorry, I actually forgot 17. So 10, 15 and 17. They've won three league titles in the last 9 years.
Well, Chelsea had this massive meltdown in the middle of the season, and that's all forgotten now. They finished third in the league.
Yeah, and could win the Europa League. And could,
well, I mean, let's be honest. If it's an Arsenal-Chelsea final, I'd be fancy Chelsea going into that final. But judging by the way Arsenal play, if they're not playing at the... Well, lately, the Arsenal have their collapse for the end of the season has been astounding. I mean, like, to have a season where at one stage they went 19 games unbeaten, to completely fall apart.
When the pressure, you were being handed an opportunity here to get top four.
And they just have so many crap, bad players in the team. It's painful looking at them. To think that, like, Christ almighty, like, you look at some of them going, Jesus Christ, if he can earn this amount of money playing in this team, how the hell are there so many players in the Premier League not playing for Arsenal? I mean, like, oh, Christ almighty. Mustafi literally has to be the worst signing Arsenal have ever made because they actually spent £30 million on him. Can you believe he cost £30 million? Like, it's phenomenal. I'm going, how Christ almighty, like.
Well, apparently he talks a lot in the dressing room, which was one of the positives that was brought up when he first arrived. Because I remember Theo Walcott saying at the time that Mustafi's a loud presence in the dressing room, and Arsenal didn't have those type of players.
It's not much use. If you're the reason your team is 2 or 3-0 down at half time, there's no point you shouting in the dressing room.
Exactly, it's counter. It does the complete opposite thing. If I'm sitting in a dressing room, Mustafi is telling me what to do and where I'm going wrong. I'm just looking at him like, what are you talking about? You sit down and think about how to defend that goal.
It's like that thing Killian talked about from the Man City documentary that Amazon did, that Fabian Delph is the loud guy, but he's actually barely playing. Like, he's the bench guy, but he's the one trying to G them up.
Yeah, it's the same as, like, Ashley Young's supposed to be a real voice in the Manchester United dressing room. And if you're Paul Pogba, you're like, ah, oh, lad, come on, give it a break.
At least for United, I think United have cause to be a little bit more optimistic because they will keep throwing money at the problem until it gets sorted.
But United don't need to. United, like, if you look at the squad, the squad United has, there's enough quality there to be finishing top four.
United do have, like, a lot of players that, like, you know, should be brilliant players. Like, I mean, and even if they decided to sell some of them, they definitely could sell Rashford for a lot of money.
Oh, absolutely. But the point is, there's no, and again, I don't like unique character, but, like, characters in there, guys who are actually going to...
I do think...
They need about five captains to sign. And, like, Ander Herrera is one of them. And we spoke already about the club letting contracts wind down to zero, which they did with Fellaini last year. Fellaini re-signed on, I'm sure, a much bigger contract than he was on before because they allowed it to run down to the very end. Mata and Herrera are two players who are doing the same thing this summer. Both of them, I don't know, Herrera, there's a lot of speculation about PSG. I wouldn't be surprised if he re-signed again. But both of them will let their contracts go down to zero and then make a decision after that, which is just mad. But Herrera is one player who United need to keep because he's probably the only player in the whole squad that I can say has that kind of character that you need to have. A captain. He's a captain.
Yeah.
And if Herrera goes, I don't know who the United captain will be next season. I mean, because there's no one there he'd say will stand out as being a captain. Obviously, Valencia's going. Who'll be the United captain next season? Herrera is the only player at the squad in the squad right now that you can say is actually captain material.
Yeah, well, I know the likes of Herrera, like, he G's up the players and he looks like he actually cares on the football pitch. But I think what United need is more than someone who's going to come in and start roaring and shouting. Like we were chatting about, like, it's no good having a Mustafi who's going to roar and shout and talk in the dressing room and G up the players if he's not backing it up on the pitch.
But Herrera's a decent player.
What United need is a Virgil van Dijk who doesn't need the captain's armband to lead. What they need is someone who's coming in and leading by example and showing character on the pitch with their ability. Doing what Virgil van Dijk is doing, which is, Virgil van Dijk is the real leader in that Liverpool team. But he doesn't roar and shout.
Yeah.
He just keeps a calm head and does his job right. And that's what United need. They need preferably in the centre half.
They need about five of those though, like right across the pitch. Centre half, you need someone in midfield, someone to actually take control of the game.
If you want to compare and contrast, I love going back in time. But like, I mean, you look at Virgil van Dijk and you look at Kompany. That's basically, you know, Keane, Adams, Vieira. That's the type of players they are. Like Vincent Kompany, central defender. Turns up and gets an absolute bolt from the blue, like, but he leads by example.
And not the first time.
And I mentioned it earlier. That's the second league title he's pretty much won by, like, with scoring goals by himself. 2012, he scored the goal that beat United, that pretty much won them the league in 2012, and the same on Monday night. So that's two league winning goals he scored for a centre half. Shows the kind of captain material that you need.
Yeah, like, I'm not really one that considers a captain to be a real thing. I don't think it matters who the captain is.
I think there are natural leaders, exactly, leader as opposed to captain.
Yeah,
exactly.
There are natural leaders.
You need a leader who's going to drag the team by the scruff of the neck, and win you games when you shouldn't be winning them. For example, and I know he's the greatest player of all time, but Lionel Messi is captain material.
Yes,
because he will win you the game
exactly
when you think you can't win.
He doesn't go around shouting, but he'll give me the ball.
Give me the ball. I'll score.
Yeah.
Vincent Kompany, like I said earlier on in the thing, everyone was writing him off against Leicester, pointing him out as the weak spot. And when City really needed him, he put in a man of the match performance and scored the winning goal. He dragged the team by the scruff of the neck. And we'll go back in time at United. Who were the leaders at United? The likes of Roy Keane.
Yeah.
He was a roaring, shouting, you know, give me the captain's armband. That's the kind of captain Roy Keane was.
But he led by example as well.
Was captain for United. Yeah. And he was the type of captain that Virgil van Dijk is. Yeah. He just led by example and he just did the basic things right and did his job right, and that's what United need as well.
Yeah. You know, and that's what's missing. Like, I mean, like, in fairness, like Koscielny is actually quite a good player, but I wouldn't regard him as completely captain material. He's not like, but
he's
just
out injured too often.
That's it. Like, I mean, you just look at Arsenal and you just go, Christ almighty, there are just problems all over. Anyway, I just have to stop talking about them.
It's upsetting.
But the thing about it is that they are going nowhere. I'd love to be proven wrong.
Apart from the last couple of months, which were atrocious by all standards, but this is the first year I've actually thought, you know what, Arsenal are actually, they've got a direction. Unai Emery knows where he's taking them. But the thing is whether or not he'll get the time to do it.
And is he going to be given the money to do it?
And is he the man to do it?
Yeah.
Potentially, there's talk now that, like, you know, Emery might be a stepping stone.
Well, he was only given a 3-year contract with the option to break it after two.
You see, he could be the guy who comes in, settles the ship, which he has done exceptionally well, to be fair to him. I know there has been a collapse, but if you look at the collapse that United had after...
Yes.
Like, Unai Emery's done an exceptional job at replacing Arsene Wenger.
I know I'm doom and gloom here, but feasibly, it could all end up great and they win the Europa League and they get into a Champions League. And then
it'd be a bit of extra money.
And, you know, even the biggest pessimist would have to be a little bit more optimistic about what could happen.
Yeah. Like, 6 years down the line at United, they're still talking about Alex Ferguson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas the ghost of... Wenger is completely wiped away.
The only thing is that a lot of it has to do with the fact that they wanted him gone at the time as well. Yeah. I mean,
but
like,
also Wenger hasn't, like, again, I love Fergie, but he's kind of hanging around. He is that shadow over the club, and I don't blame him. And
he's been back though. He hasn't been back to watch them since he left.
Fergie.
No,
Wenger has left completely.
Whereas Ferguson is still there.
And that's not Ferguson's fault. He's entitled to go to games. He's a director at the club. But at the same time, he is still there. And the issue now, and as much as you'd love Solskjaer to succeed, people are still saying, You know, he's one of Fergie's guys. He's Fergie Mark II. They're going to bring in Rio Ferdinand, maybe as the director of football. And you're like, oh, guys, like, it's very much, it feels very much like Liverpool 1992 when they were like, okay, well, this is not working out. Who can we get from the boot room that's going to replace? Okay, we'll get Roy Evans in, sure.
Did you not know that Alex Ferguson was managing Manchester United for that 17 win streak that Solskjaer went on, or unbeaten streak?
Yeah, yeah.
But suddenly, oh, you know what? Solskjaer is not the man. I don't. After this collapse, you know, Alex Ferguson, that he just let the reins go after, you know, Solskjaer settled in. He was taking the training sessions. He was managing United. But now they're in a dark spot, you know, it's Solskjaer's team.
Like, I mean, fair enough. Liverpool are unbelievable now, and Man City are. Man City had a, like, the thing about it is, and like, when you look at the way Man City and Liverpool operate, it looks so easy. You do kind of go, why doesn't everybody do that? Essentially, they both identified managers that they needed, but like, it does help that they're two of the best managers in the world. But they backed them up then with the money they wanted to do the job. And like, the two managers fit the philosophy of the team as well, which makes a big difference. I mean, upon mature reflection, Mourinho never fit the United ethos.
And I said that from the very start. I think there's probably a recording of me saying this.
I have, but most people would have said it was a good hiring.
No, I was completely against it from the start, because he's not a Manchester United manager. He's a very good manager, but he's not a Manchester United manager. Yeah. And it's kind of been proven that... He's a Celtic manager, apparently. But it's kind of been proven that, yeah, the board didn't back him. So, like, the board obviously didn't feel he was the right manager. Yeah. If they felt that you're bringing in the wrong players, you know. I remember when he was appointed, he said, I will play the Manchester United way. The team won't play the Mourinho way. They'll play the Manchester United way, and I will bend to the Manchester United way.
And then he just played the Mourinho
way. And after about 6 weeks... And that was the issue. He was caught between a rock and a hard place, insofar as he wanted to play his way, but he also wanted to play the United way, and he was stuck. And I think that was half the problem.
And in
with
the end, they didn't have any way of playing.
But like I said that from the very start, that he wasn't a Manchester United manager. And at least that's the one thing about Solskjaer, is he knows about the club. He knows a lot more about the club and how the club should play.
Yes.
Not saying it's going to work out, but at least he knows how the club should play. Whereas Mourinho, yeah, obviously
even
didn't.
With Mourinho, actually, I couldn't imagine him with Celtic. I can imagine him at Rangers for some reason.
That's
not going to happen.
Stupid.
It's been...
He is completely... the antithesis of Celtic.
But also, what would he be thinking going to Celtic?
No, it's not going to happen. We're not giving this any credence.
It plays into his ego. It absolutely...
Well, just go up and win the league every season with no minimal effort.
Yeah. But you're an absolute... Picture this. You're an absolute egomaniac who only cares about success. And you have the chance to be the manager who goes down in Scottish football history as the man who brought 10 in a row. Plus, you only have to stay there 2 seasons and you don't have to put up with any nonsense.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you get to wind up the most wind-upable, if that's a word.
Yeah, it is a word.
Fans in the world. He would thrive at Celtic.
Would you? You're a Celtic fan.
He would love it. I would hate it.
Why?
I would love it and hate it at the same time. But because I know he would... He would 100% win the next 2 titles.
Oh, of course he would.
He'd win the... the 5 trebles in a row, and he'd win the 10 in a row.
Sure, I don't think Gerrard's going to stay at Rangers much longer.
He would drive Steven Gerrard to the grave at Rangers.
That's a bit sinister.
Drive
him south of the border?
The thing that would put him off is that he'd have no money to spend.
He wouldn't.
Yeah.
But I think he'd still do the job.
Anyway, it's a bit of a pipe dream.
It's not going to happen. Yeah. It's not going to happen. Celtic are probably going to do the 10 in a row, though.
They're going to do it anyway. Yeah. It's just what manager...
For Christ almighty,
I think the point of Mourinho is, like, he'll be in a job at the start of next season. And if PSG want him, he'll go.
If PSG have it, like, I mean, if rumours are to be believed, that money is not long for this world, and that, like, they're talking about you know, there's rumors that they're going to be pulling out of their financing of PSG after the next World Cup and all this kind of stuff, which would leave PSG in a tough position.
Yeah, but the point would be that Mourinho will go to PSG if they want him. If they don't, where else is there for him to go, really?
Mourinho will definitely go to PSG if they want him. Of course,
but I don't know if they do want him.
That's the point. So if he doesn't go to PSG,
Italy, it'll be somewhere in Italy. there's a few clubs, I think they're looking at Conte as their first option and then Mourinho as their number two option. So Roma, apparently Conte's turned them down. Mourinho could go there. Can't really see it, but there's Inter as well or Milan.
No, it's Celtic all the way, guys.
I say Jonathan is having an interesting time. In
yeah, sorry, we're recording this as Liverpool are playing Barcelona and looks like the comeback is semi-on.
I have to admit I'm a bit sickened to see that second goal go in.
I can't wait until Lionel Messi.
The comeback is well and truly on now. I mean, like considering the players Liverpool are missing, it's a pretty good performance.
It's the Anfield effect.
Well, anyway, let's switch
this
to
is gonna
something
be
else.
A hell of, we're in for a hell of, it's going to be a hell of a last half hour, anyway.
Yeah, but anyway, myself, Enda and Cian Roach were interviewing Stephanie Roach, who is a Landis ambassador, and it's for Helen Back, which, of course, is also in aid of Pieta House, so they'll be raising money as well by taking part. So here's that interview.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. Raf Giallo here, and also Enda Call, who's one of the regulars from the show, and Cian Roach as well. But we do have a special guest. It is Stephanie Roach, who is back from Italy. You're here as a brand ambassador for Landis, and they are sponsoring Helen Back, which I have experience of, good experience. Survived, I think, is the main thing. So it's coming back June 15 to 16 for the first time again. And obviously, it's all also for great cause as well, which is helping Pieta House, which is brilliant. In terms of doing things like Helen Back, and for those who don't know, it's like an endurance kind of I wouldn't say competition, but it goes it runs across around 10 kilometers. Have you done anything like that before, or as a player, are you even allowed to?
Yeah, not quite. Yeah, like it's obviously it's a mental and physical endurance course, really, and it's been given the name as the toughest in Ireland, so I haven't had a chance to do it just yet, but I've gone the last 3 years and been there and seen it, and I've always said I want to try and do it, but I'm always in contract, so I always have an excuse not to do it.
Take your time about doing it, because I struggle through it. Like, I'm not a naturally fit person, so to do 10 kilometres where you're jumping, climbing, wading through, I'm not sure what it was.
Yeah.
Mud, mostly. But
it's pretty cool to do with a group of people. And obviously, I think a lot of people do it for good causes as well. Like, Landis are doing their fundraiser for Pieta House this year by doing Helen Back as well, which is a great cause. So I think a lot of people who do it do the same thing. So it's all going towards a good cause. And at the end of the day, it can be a bit of crack as well. Like, it's a bit of fun. I've always seen people who go to a scene to enjoy it and come away from it unharmed, which is always the fear going into it,
relative,
I think.
Relatively unharmed by your dignity in my case.
Exactly.
But speaking of adventures and that kind of thing, you're back from Italy. What's the situation with the club Florentia at the moment in terms of your own future?
Yeah, I've just finished my season. It's been a weird time because I feel like, obviously, I've been talking about my injury for a while, the last few years, and now it's kind of, I'm unlucky with timing because I feel like every time I'm getting going, a season finishes. Like, before I got going, after my injury originally, I had just finished up with Sunderland. They had the issues they had with the men's club obviously going down, and that affected the women's side. So the women's team went down to the lower divisions, and it was my decision whether to stay there, which wouldn't have been good for me personally, so I decided to leave. And at that stage, I was without a club, having been out injured for a year, and then I finally got the opportunity to go to Italy. And as I said, just as I feel like I was getting going, the season was finished. So again, timing wasn't on my side, but I've enjoyed it. I'm back fully fit. Tip wood, nothing's happened wrong, nothing's gone wrong the last couple of months, and I'm happy to be back playing at a high level. And as I said, being fully fit is something that I don't want to let go again, because getting back to fitness was the hardest thing ever. So it's been good
and
to be
how
back.
How did you find the adaptation off the pitch as well? Because obviously it's another culture. You've experienced France, the USA, England, and now it's another completely different football culture. And even things like food and everything else, it's all quite different to what we're used to here. How did you find it?
Yeah, it's just different. I think the Italians are very laid back. Even just with my I had to wait a couple of months for my residency and my registration to go through, and every day I was like, what's going on, like, why isn't it true, I want to play, and they were just so lax about it. I was like, oh, it's okay, it'll go through, and a few players had the same issues with it. So it's been great, to be honest with you. I've really enjoyed the football, I've really enjoyed the lifestyle away from football, and a lot of the people at the club have been really nice, and I've been lucky enough as well. My auntie lives in Rome, so she's been close by as well if I ever need anything, and my family have come over quite a bit as well, so it's made it good, and it's flew in, to be honest. I was there for 7.5-8 months, and it's gone so quickly, so that's always a good sign, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very good sign. Even outside of, I suppose, the league as well is quite strong. You know, you have the Juventus Women's, Roma. A lot of clubs seem to have, at least they're affiliated to the main men's team. Your club is quite different in that sense.
Yeah, our club has actually just been going now 5 years. So what happened was, a guy came in, he wanted to invest in women's football, and he was going to go with Fiorentina, and it didn't work out for some reason. or another, and he ended up making his own team. And they, over 5 years, they climbed up all the leagues, and we've got to the top league. And the team done really well. Before I was able to play, the team were doing really well, and we ended up finishing up in sixth position, I think it was, which is great for your first season in the top league. And it's just, it's great to see that somebody like Tommaso, the guy who's involved, has put that money into the women's football, and it's been a great year for me personally, as I said.
Stephanie, just going across to the other side of Europe, it's a difficult thing to do in any sense when you're going into a new job, but football's a kind of an anomaly in itself. When you're moving over to Italy and you've been out for a year, like you said, with an injury, and especially with the women's game, they might not have had the chance to maybe see on the TV as much as, say, if a man was moving across to Italy. Did you feel that you had to prove yourself more to the players when you started to gain full fitness to actually show them what you can do on the pitch?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's been a case everywhere I've gone the last few years. I think obviously the Puskas and everything that came with that gave me a huge profile and people knew about me. So it was a case of me going there and making sure that I proved to the players that I was there because I'm a good footballer and not because people know who I am, if that makes sense. So that's probably been the hardest thing for me since everything that happened. But again, coming back from injury is hard to do when you're with a team who you've played with your whole life. But when you're going into a new team, you're trying to do your best. And I probably went in kind of doing too much because I ended up having a little bit of a knockback. And the physio and the strength and conditioning coach had said that it came from doing too much too soon. So I obviously went in all guns blazing, wanting to prove that I could play in the league and I could compete and do well for the team. And I'd done that quite well. And obviously I set myself back. So it was a case of just, for me personally, sitting back and going, look, get yourself back to fitness. Once you're fully fit, you'll be able to show what you can do. And that's, without being cocky, that's kind of what you have to do as a footballer. You have to believe in what you can do for the team.
So do you think the Puskas Award might have been a hindrance in a way?
I wouldn't.
Maybe your reputation might have preceded you before you actually got to prove that.
Yeah,
you know,
I think more so. I wouldn't say hindrance because it was an unbelievable experience for me, obviously, as a footballer, to be able to mix with them type of players and to be involved in what I was involved in. But at the same time, I think, as I said, a lot of people only know of me in new clubs because of that. They might not have seen me play properly before. Maybe, I suppose, going to Florentia was different because I played with Sunderland for 3 years and a couple of the girls at Florentia played in England and have played against me. So they were able to tell girls, look, she played in the top league in England, she's a good player type of thing. So that kind of helped with that, I suppose. But I suppose going to Sunderland, it would have been that because a lot of the girls wouldn't have known a lot about me. And it would have been a case of just coming in and trying to show what I was doing. But I don't like using the word hindrance, but it's just different. It's a different kind of...
Would there have been a target on your head slightly for defenders, maybe?
I wouldn't say that. I think it's more so people kind of going, look, that's a great goal, but can she do it again type of thing. And that's the type of thing that you're dealing with. And those type of things in football don't happen all the time. So it was a case for me to say to them, look, I'm not going to be scoring overhead kicks every week, but I will do my best to help the team, you know, like on the way. So...
Yeah, the Puskas actually, I suppose it shows the benefit of actually filming and having, you know, cameras there, because normally that game, when you did it at the time, it wouldn't have been on camera, but I think it was your manager, wasn't it?
It was the Westwood manager actually recording it. Yeah. So it's happening now, a lot of women's football, particularly here in Ireland, with it not being a professional league. A lot of the clubs are trying to take a professional approach to it and record all the games, which is great, not just in case something like that happens, but just for their own personal kind of benefit within the players to kind of go through the games and see what they could have done better for the games. You see the best teams in the world are all doing the video analysis, so it's not a bad thing to do. And thankfully, from my point of view, they were recording that game and they caught it, yeah.
Yeah, and attendances in Italy as well. I noticed Juventus, I think when they were playing Fiorentina recently, it was up to 39,000.
Yeah, they sold that. They got to play in the Allianz.
And then Barcelona versus Atletico and the Wanda Metropolitano, again, something like 60,000 as well. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a trend, I think, and even if we go off soccer, one of the ladies' football finals there recently between Dublin and it was Mayo at the time. Again, huge attendance in Croke Park as well. So again, we're seeing a good trend of, you know, people taking an interest and actually going to games as well.
Yeah, I think with football, it's important that, like, I think women's football obviously is a long way behind men's football, and it's going to be a long time before it's competing with it. But I think it also needs the help of men's football to get to where it needs to get to. And you've seen that with the Atletico Madrid and Barcelona game. You had a lot of Atletico Madrid and Barcelona. How many fans have they got all over the world?
Yeah.
So if you're promoting that within your men's game, go and watch our ladies team play, and a lot of people will go. And I've said this so many times over the years, I think when people go and actually watch the game, they might kind of go, oh, do you know what, this is quite good, it's not something, I didn't think it was going to be that good. Because we get a lot of stick from men saying it's not on the same level as men's football, and I don't think it is myself personally, but it's getting there, and it's a different type of football. And I think if people go and watch it, they'll want to come back and watch it. And it takes kind of, as I said, the men's game to try and help the women's game along in order for that to happen. And it happened with Juventus and Fiorentina as well. They had the Allianz Stadium in Juventus to play in, and also obviously in Spain it happened too. So it's great to see, and I hope it happens more.
Yeah, we actually had two of your international teammates, Louise Quinn and Katie McCabe, on the show after Arsenal won the league there last weekend. And Louise was saying that at Arsenal, the women's team mixes with the men's team, and Emery comes in, and they might be the women's team, they share the same training facilities, they get treated equally the same, except for maybe the likes of the pay gap that would be there. So do you find that's an approach that most teams should be taking?
Yeah, I think so. I had the same when I was at Sunderland, my first 2 years at Sunderland. It's the same thing as what Louise was saying. We shared the same training ground, the same facilities. We ate in the canteen with the lads. Like, and it was kind of, it just makes you feel part of the club, and it makes the club feel as one. And I think that's something that needs to happen with women's football. It can't be, this is the men's team, that's the women's team. You know, we're not all together as such, and that's kind of what's needed, I think, in terms of the women's game to grow and stuff. And I think in England, it's definitely got better with this, particularly the Premier League clubs who are involved with the women's sides.
Do you think they should scrap the title altogether then?
Well,
just have, this is the Arsenal women's team, but don't call them the Arsenal women's team, they're just a separate branch and it's a separate league for women?
Well, I think the Premier League are actually coming on board, I think, in the next few years with the Women's National League in England, the Super League. So that's another step towards it, because it's not just the Women's Super League, the Men's Premier League, it's going to be the Premier League, the Women's and the Men's. And obviously there has to be a difference in both of them, but I think what we're asking for is to be given the same chance and the same kind of opportunities to play, and to be given the right chances to do that. And I think a lot of the clubs in England are going towards that. And I think that helps with England doing so well at the World Cup. I think that's something that the whole country got behind England. And if that can happen with us here in Ireland, I think it can definitely happen here too.
It appears that it is trending in that direction. I think the FA Cup finalists, the attendance for this year's FA Cup appears to be trending in the direction that's going to break last year's attendance as well. And with West Ham and Manchester City involved, you've got players, obviously Irish interest as well. But obviously, with those players involved in the international scene as well, like last month they would have had friendly against Italy over in Italy. Did you get to get down and see them at all?
I was training at the time, actually, but I've spoke to Colin Bell quite a lot, and obviously I'm in touch with a lot of the girls within the squad as well, and Colin's been great with me, to be fair, because I think for me personally, I needed to make sure I got back fit properly, and that if I went into the Ireland squad, I'm giving something back, and not just going in and kind of being part of the squad. Like, for me personally, I want to be able to go in and give towards the team, and Colin, I've spoke to him numerous times. I text him pretty much every week. I haven't texted him in a while, I must text him. But I've been in touch and letting him know where I'm at fitness-wise, and I want to be involved within the squads. And I was actually named in the provisional squad for that, but in the end we decided that it was probably best that I wait and get the last few games of the season in and then go from there. So I'm obviously still eager to play for Ireland. I've played for Ireland my whole career pretty much, so it's something that I want to get back involved in, but I want to make sure that I'm physically in the right condition to get in there and show what I can do.
Because you were talking to Emma Duffy at the 42 back in February, and the feeling around the time was that you were kind of not rushing yourself, but you felt at the time you were ready to go back in and that you weren't, and there was a bit of a period of frustration now. Like, has that passed? Do you feel like physically you're capable now of, because you said before you were capable of getting the 90 minutes in, like, is that a position that you feel that you're in now that you can give back to the team and Colin Bell's side?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's when I spoke to Emma, I hadn't started a game. I'd only been coming on in bits and bobs here in a few of the games and played maybe 20 minutes. I played a half then a couple of months after that, or a couple of weeks after that. So I gradually was building up my match fitness, but towards the end of the season I was playing full matches, so I was happy enough. I started the last game of the season and I played with no trouble. I felt fit as a fiddle, you know, like, on the way. So I do feel like, as a player, you're always going to say you're fit and you want to play, but you need people, I suppose, like Colin, to kind of say to you, look, how many have you played? What are you doing? How many games have you played and where you're at, like, physically? And for me personally, I just want to play. I don't be thinking of that, but I think for me right now, after having the injuries I've had, I have to be clever about it as well. And thankfully, as I said, I've been flying the last few months. We've done fitness tests and I think I was second best in the whole squad. So I feel like I'm at a stage now where I'm able to compete again and be able to give back to the Irish team if I do get called in.
And when you look at the likes of the striking quality that the Irish team have at the moment, like Amber Barrett, Rhianna Jarrett, these are two players who are playing their football in the Women's National League over here. Like, is that a reflection of the strength of the league, and is that something that you would see a possibly a return to Piemont or another Women's National team, Women's National League team in the future?
For myself?
Yeah.
It's not something I'd rule out. I think for me personally, I've enjoyed playing at a higher level for a long time now, and I think when I went abroad to play professional football first, it was a huge step up, and it's something that I probably didn't think of. I thought, like, I was top goal scorer in the Women's National League before I went away. I was playing in a really good Piemont team and I felt like we had a great squad. But then when I went to play in America and in France and then on to England, every player in the team is really, really good and really, really fit, and you have so much more to compete with. So for me personally, I think I'm 29, I'm 30 in June. I'd like to try and play at a higher level for as long as I can. So right now, my ambition is to stay playing professional football for a couple more years at least. And then obviously I love to play in Ireland. I've got a lot of friends who play in Piemont and other teams that are in the league. So if I did come back, I definitely will play in the league again. But I hope to play for a long time. So we'll see how long I go.
And what have you taken from each league, actually, interestingly enough, from, say, Ireland? I mean, stylistically and in terms of what you learn technically, from England, USA, etc. What's the major difference and what do you pick up from each one?
Yeah, there's a couple of differences. I think in Ireland, I think we're I don't like to say a little bit behind because I don't want to be disrespectful, but I think in England, you're fully professional. The girls here in Ireland, they're trying to get better. They were training 2 times a week. I think they're training 3 times, some clubs 4 times a week, which is only going to be better for the league. But I do know when I was in America, it was a different style of play in terms of football. The training regime in all the countries have been pretty similar. But in America, it was more so about strength and fitness and being able to power through a game. In England, it was a bit of both. It was that and it was technical. A lot of the players are very good on the ball and very good technically. So every time you played the game, you kind of had to be on the ball. It wasn't a case of just running around for 90 minutes. But I think France and Italy have been quite similar. They're both kind of a little bit more time on the ball. I think it's a little bit more technical. You're not kind of rushed as much. But I've really enjoyed Italy, I have to say. I think it suits my style of play. I like to get on the ball and play a little bit, and I've been able to do that there. So it's been kind of, I suppose I could take a little mix from every country I've played in and say that in certain parts it's similar, but there's each one has their little different bits as well.
Yeah, you've started taking coaching badges, of course, I suppose, with an eye to the future. And one of the things I was interested just kind of when I was reading about you was you'd interned, I think, with the FAI in and around futsal, which, of course, for anybody who's involved in street football, as you would have been, yeah. It's something that I think maybe we should be doing more here. Is that something maybe you'd look to advocate maybe in time goes by, once your career finishes, maybe to, you know, maybe give a bit of a profile to futsal and see can we integrate that into the way players are developed?
Yeah, I've met up with a couple of people. Emma Switzer actually is involved in the 5-a-sides, 6-a-sides and 7-a-sides, and I would love to get involved with that. I think it is. I love kind of the futsal as in tight spaces and quick football and quick feet, and that's something that I like to do and I like to play. And I loved the course when I was on it because we got to play every day in the indoor hall and we went outside and played as well. So it's definitely something that I think has helped my career quite a bit. But for me personally, I think I'd like to get involved in just normal coaching when I finish. I've just actually started up my own coaching company. And we've had a couple of camps over the last kind of midterm breaks within schools, and also we're in schools doing after school sessions and in school sessions. So that's probably something that I'm hoping to build throughout my career now as I'm playing, so that when I finish up, I'll be able to come back to that. And I really enjoy coaching, and it's something that I kind of want to give back when I finish.
Yeah, of course, there'd be the skills coaching, but I suppose there's the other side as well of what a player can expect in the professional game. So I guess that might be another part of it that you'd like to instill maybe in young players coming through.
Yeah, I think it's even just giving them an insight maybe. I think I've done that at a couple of places. I've gone to do a little bit of speaking and stuff with young kids or people who are interested in having a career in not just football but in sports, and I suppose trying to tell them the dedication that's needed or explain to them what they need to do to be able to get onto that pathway and to stay on it. Because I've seen so many people who played football for years and gave it up because they either had work commitments or they had other stuff they had to go with, and thankfully I've been able to play football at a high level and stick at it for a long time. So hopefully I'll be able to, as you say, help kids who maybe want to do the same thing.
Yeah, actually it's just a year on as well from, 2 years on actually, because it was April 2017 from the press conference, of course, where I can tell from your reaction. But look, it was where you kind of discussed the issues that the Irish team at the time were facing, even the example of having to, you know, no training tracksuits, having to change in airports and things like that. In terms of the last 2 years since then, have you seen any improvement, or what's the, well, obviously there have been improvements, but in what ways has that actually manifested itself?
I think there's definitely been improvements. I think that goes without saying. I think a lot of the girls, I've spoke to a lot of the girls within the squad. Obviously, with me being injured, I haven't been around the squad as much as I would have been before. But I think we all knew with Colin coming in, he's got a great pedigree as a manager and he's a very professional guy. So we knew with him coming in that a lot of the stuff we were asking for was going to come naturally through him. But it was a case of us kind of saying, look, if we're going to compete with other nations, if you look at Scotland women's team, I mean, they've come on leaps and bounds over the last 5-6 years. And we were kind of saying, look, if we want to get to a finals tournament, we're going to need these certain things to be done. And I think it came at a stage where we had just changed manager. It was a new regime. And we were like, this is the best time to do it. Let's go and do it now. And it wasn't the case that we wanted to be like the focus and people to look at us and put ourselves out there. It was more so we were trying to do it behind closed doors and get it done without anyone knowing about it. And then we had the PFEI come on board and help us, and it just seemed that no one was listening to us, so we went for it then, and that's how it all came about. But as I said, I think it was a case of, I've talked about this obviously so many times over the last few years since it happened, but I think it was more a case of it needed to be put in front of them, say, look, this is what we need. If we don't get this, we're not going to be able to compete. And then it was a case of, right, look, we didn't realise, not that we didn't realise, but it was kind of like it needed to be said for it to be put into place and for it to be implemented. And as I said, thankfully, it's all took off over the last few months, and the girls kind of showed within the qualifiers last year that we can compete with the biggest countries in the world. And it's going to take a little bit more work. We're not quite there just yet, but thankfully we're getting the backing we need now, and it's up to us.
What's the next step for Irish women's football internationally? Like, didn't qualify for the World Cup, unfortunately, this year.
Yeah.
So where would you take the international team now? What's a realistic aim for them?
I think even before the World Cup qualifiers, and obviously as a footballer or as anyone involved with the team, you can't say, look, we're not going to qualify for the World Cup, we're concentrating on Euro. But I think looking back now, if you were to speak to anybody, I think Colin has a new squad of players, really. A lot of new players coming in, a lot of young players mixed with the players that have been there for a good while. And I think the World Cup qualifiers are always very, very difficult to get out of those groups. So I think anybody who knows women's football will probably have looked at it and said, let's do our best for this, but let's really focus on the Euro qualifiers, because it's a little bit easier to get out, not easier, but it's never easy to get out of a group. But I think it's a little bit in terms of there's more places in the group to get through. Yeah. The World Cup is only one spot, and then it's the playoffs, and it's a little harder to get through. So I think the overall aim would always have been to get through to the Euro finals, and that's something that I think a lot of the players are focused on.
And you'd be hopeful to get into the squad during that qualification?
I hope so. As I said, I've been speaking to Colin quite a bit, and right now I'm in my off season, but a lot of the girls are finishing up soon as well. So my plan would be to hopefully get a good pre-season under myself before the qualifiers start.
Now that you're finished with Florentia for now, and you, like you said, you're in talks on your contract with them, do you think maybe a move closer to home, back to England or France, would be beneficial for you in your attempts to get back into their Ireland international squad then?
I don't think so. I think Colin doesn't mind where you're playing as long as you're playing. And I think that's something he's made quite clear. He wants you playing games, and he's trying to bring it into the Irish League here. He wants you training every chance you get. And that's something that I've been lucky to do over the last 4, 5, 6 years of my career. Like, I'm training all the time. But for me personally, before I went to Italy, I probably did say to myself that I want to get back to England. I think it's a really good league, and it's something that I feel like I still have a bit to do. And I think I don't think I'd done everything I needed to do. When I played at Sunderland, I played a majority of my time there at left wing back, yeah, which is, if anyone knows me, it's an alien position to me. Like, I play up front, but I got better at it as I went along, and I think I'd done really well when I was there. But for me personally, I'd love to go and really show what I can do as a forward player, and that's something that's always going to be in my mind. But at the same time, Florentia have been really good to me. They've helped me get back from injury, so they have offered me a new contract. It's just a case of getting the kind of bits and bobs together as such. But I haven't said anything yet. I'm kind of keeping my options open for a few weeks.
Before you went to Italy, there was mention of Manchester United potentially hooking up with Casey Stone, and now that they're climbing the divisions, yeah, in England, is that something that you might return to as well?
Yeah, I think I was misquoted with a lot of that stuff. Like, see, I basically done an interview with a guy who runs a United review page on Twitter, like, and obviously a United fan, and he knew I was a United fan, and he asked me would I like to play for Man United, and as a Man United fan, I'm always obviously going to say I'd love to play for the club, like, but for me personally at the time, it wasn't really an option. I was just back from injury, but it was just a case of me saying, look, that's the dream. You want to play for the club you follow as a kid, and the club I still follow it to this day. Like, so it's something that if the opportunity came up, definitely I wouldn't turn it down. And I've said before, I'd play for United for free, but I don't know if I would really. But yeah, it's as I said, it was kind of not misquoted, but I think people interpreted that I was going there when I said it, but no, it's just something like, that I'd like to do.
Like if the likes of Romelu Lukaku is asked, he says he always dreamed of playing in Italy. That doesn't mean he's actually necessarily going to play in Italy.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, just in terms of the international scene, so Germany are the standout team in the group that you're facing, the Euros, and obviously they're playing at the World Cup. The World Cup's obviously starting very, very soon as well. Is that something you're going to be obviously keeping an eye on? But in terms of who you think is going to win or challenge, it seems quite a broad spectrum, like in comparison to maybe past tournaments. So who do you kind of see challenging maybe for those top like semi-finals, etc. places?
Yeah, I think obviously based on the last few tournaments, you'd have to look at the likes of England and France. I think France, Germany, in fairness, obviously have always been a very, very good club or a good country, particularly in women's football. They've been the powerhouse really for a long time. But with the likes of the USA and France coming up and England coming up, I think they're going to be the teams who will be around. And I think one thing to mention is that the games are going to be live on RTÉ and TG Cahir as well over June and July, which is great to see, so more people can see. And again, I think that helps women's football in Ireland as well as everything else, so it's going to be good to see. But I think England could do really well. I think they've got the players to do it. They've got young players coming through and they've got the kind of experience of getting the third place in the World Cup, so and the last in Canada. So I think it's going to be an interesting tournament, but there'll be some really good games involved.
If you're running those camps, if you're running camps and stuff like that after the summer with the World Cup on, are you expecting an upsurge of people getting involved in it? Like, is that one of the potential benefits and the offshoots of having something like this televised and having it so accessible on terrestrial TV?
Yeah, I think so. I think you get it with every sport, don't you? I mean, when the tennis is on, everyone's out with their tennis rackets trying to play a little bit or whatever. But I think even just from personal experience, when I played in England, and I've mentioned this a few times, when they done really well in Canada, they came third. I think the support we had coming to the games, it skyrocketed. Like, we had a lot of people coming and watching the games, and I know the FA had talked about how it was great to see so many people coming to the games, and they wanted to try and see how they could keep that going, obviously, off the backlash, off the team doing so well. So I think with the women's game being live on television and young girls and boys obviously getting to see it, I think it will definitely encourage people wanting to get out and play a little bit more. No less so than the men's World Cup being on television gets people wanting to go out and play a little bit. So.
Yeah, I guess one of the interesting things as well, just reading it today, Norway's Ada Hegerberg, who's one of the best players in the world, not going to the tournament. Again, that's a loss, obviously, for Norway, but you kind of want all the best players there. I think it's probably the main thing.
Yeah, definitely. I think she's had a little bit of trouble with the Norwegian national team. I think they got a little bit of sick after the last World Cup, and I think she got a lot of the backlash because she is one of their best players, and they probably didn't do as well as they wanted to do, so it's disappointing that she's not there. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but obviously, if you have a chance to play for your country, I don't think there should be anything in the way, but it's not my place to say.
Yeah, and obviously there's some amazing players going over, as you mentioned, some of the England ones. I remember Marta from a few tournaments ago as well, again, another kind of street footballer as well. In terms of players you've faced, in terms of the best you've ever faced, who would you kind of pick out at this point?
There's been quite a few. I think, obviously, Carly Lloyd has been unbelievable over the last few years in terms of, I suppose, how long she's kept at a high level, and she's been consistent, and I was able to play with her in Euston Dash when I was there, and she was a really nice girl as well. So I think she's obviously a phenomenal player. She's probably the one that stands out in terms of the all-round game and how she plays the game, so I'd be probably her.
Oh, good stuff. So best of luck anyway with the qualifiers. As I said, you've Germany, Ukraine, and then I think Montenegro, didn't you score a hat-trick against them at some point before?
Yeah.
So that'll be quite a reunion.
So yeah, maybe we might get brought back in for that one.
Yeah, so hopefully, look, as you kind of said, like, qualifying for a tournament would be huge. I mean, in terms of bringing people in, bringing in interest. So if that can happen, it would definitely be amazing in terms of bringing on improvements. But Stephanie Roach, thanks a million for coming in.
Thanks for having you guys.
Brand ambassador for Hell and Back. While I survived, it definitely is well worth doing. So if you can, it's for a great cause as well, Pieta House.
All right, that is Stephanie Roach, Ireland International, on the show. So that's it pretty much for this week's show. Remarkably, the scores in the Liverpool-Barcelona game have not changed. Are they about to change? No. That's it for this week's
Barcelona
show.
Barcelona are currently on the rack.
Yeah, they have been on the rack during the duration of that entire interview that we were listening to.
They had a couple of decent chances. Oh!
Oh, no!
Oh my God! No!
Bloody Wijnaldum!
Three Wijnaldum again!
No, this is the goal to Rome again. Because this is the same thing that happened to Barcelona last year.
That was an unbelievable header.
It was a very good header.
Oh my God, Barcelona are in tatters.
Now here's the chance for Messi to step up and be captain material.
This is it now. This is Messi has to prove his worth here.
Well, and Suarez,
if you know what I mean, like.
Yeah.
But like Suarez and Messi like really have to do something here. And there's 35 minutes to go.
By the way, I love how
there were 36 minutes to go when we started the interview with Stephanie Rochner.
By the way, I love how Suarez, like all Liverpool fans obviously love Suarez from his time there. And after last week they all are very annoying and hate him.
I liked how he celebrated. I think you should do that more.
Yeah.
This is insane. Anyway, Raf, let's wrap up the show.
Yeah, anyway, Joe Coffey, thanks for coming in.
Raf, pleasure as always.
Derek Ryan.
Thank you, Raf.
Enda.
Thank you.
Take it away, Johan. Boom.